Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. I thought I'd open the program today with a nice comment. And this is from the state of Indiana. Hello, JBL. Thank you so much for the study of the King James Bible. It has added so much to my studies. Some religions and people say that reading and studying the Bible can make you go mad. But this JBL series on the King James Bible should be encouraging to all who listen. So I thought that was a great comment. Well, today we begin our late fall book series featuring famous utopian and dystopian literature. I just want you to know I'm really excited to start this series. I think we've chosen some very interesting books, and in fact, we may actually add a few to it. But to give you a frame of reference for understanding the importance of this series, let's define our terms. So let's start with the term utopia. Now, if you just look it up in any dictionary, obviously you can find a good definition. But here's one I got off the internet. Utopia, it is a noun. It says, an imagined place or state of things in which everything is perfect. The word was first used in the book Utopia in 1516 by Sir Thomas More. Now, that is the common definition of utopia. Notice it says there it's an imagined place or state of things in which everything is perfect. Now, the definition is absolutely true. It was Sir Thomas More that actually coined the term utopia, and we'll talk about that a little bit in a few minutes. Now, the definition of dystopia. And so this is very important. It's also a noun, but the definition is an imagined place or state in which everything is unpleasant or bad, typically a totalitarian or an environmentally degraded one. Now, I could add to this definition, generally, a dystopian novel or a dystopian piece of literature can also be terrifying. It can be nightmarish in the sense that what people are living through is really kind of like having a very bad dream. Now, I think it's really interesting as we, again, as I started to prepare for the series and as we go through the series, I think that one thing that you would even find interesting is that you cannot find a lot of books describing what a utopia would be or what it would look like. So we have Thomas More's book, and there are a few other ones. But if you were to go to a bookstore, and I hope you're a frequent bookstore a visitor like I am. I love to go to bookstores. Even if I don't buy books, I just go like to look at books. But if you went to a bookstore and you ask for the utopian section of books, you might find one shelf or maybe a half of a shelf that would devote space to utopian books because there really just aren't many. And you're most likely would be finding this section near the philosophy section. And unless you're really into philosophy, you're probably not even going to be looking for the philosophy section. However, if you went into the bookstore and tried to find the dystopian section of books, you would find a completely different situation. You would more than likely find an entire section of bookshelves for dystopian literature. And you would also find quite a large section of dystopian literature in the young adult section of the bookstore. Now, here are two questions I want to ask you to get you to think about what I've just read and explained to you about dystopia and utopia. Why do you think there are a very few books on the subject of utopia? And what does it mean that the dystopian literature is now the prevalent trend in young adult literature? And so there is something to all that. And of course, we'll talk about that somewhat in this introduction. But here's another question I want to ask you. And I want you to consider this, and I want you to think about this. Do you believe it is possible that a utopia could exist? And I think that begins to explain somewhat why there are not very many utopian books and why there are a lot of dystopian books. So today for our special program, and we're going to go a little bit longer than just our normal half-hour program, I'd like to investigate why we have few books on utopia and yet a growing number of books on dystopia. Now, let's speak in general terms about the history behind Thomas More's utopia to begin today. So I'm going to read to you from a transcript that I have of a course, and it's by an instructor. Her name is Badeau, and she is a professor of English at the University of Connecticut. But it's really interesting is Thomas More wrote on utopia in the year 1516. Now, if you know anything about Thomas More, some people refer to him as Sir Thomas More. If you look at the Catholic Church, they call him Saint Thomas More, and he is a canonized saint in that church. But he was a very highly respected member of English Parliament, and he did know about government. He thought about government, and I'm sure he thought an awful lot about society as a whole and what would make a perfect society. And so he began writing a story of an isolated island, and he called it New Squamah. Now, that's really a Latin word, New Squamah. Here's what New Squamah means. It comes from the Latin word New Squam, which means nowhere and on no occasion. So essentially, he began writing this book. He called it New Squamah. And for more, New Squamah represented an imaginary realm, a no place, in which he could really try out a number of philosophical, political, or social ideas. Now, we also know that More was a very well-educated man. He knew both Greek and Latin. He did study the philosophy of both Greece, or the Greeks, I should say. Not, I was going to say both Greece and Rome, but he really studied a lot of Greek philosophy. Now, he did, again, when he was writing this book, he was really contemplating what a perfect society would look like. Now, we can be thankful, I think, that he changed the name of New Squamah to Utopia. And, you know, can you imagine that we do call the genre of books Utopia for utopian. They are the utopian genre. I can't imagine having a genre titled New Squamah. I mean, can you imagine if I would offer a series of programs on JBL saying, well, we're going to now study the New Squamah, genre of books. It kind of reminds me of like a microbiotic organism that's going to get in and do some damage to your body. So we don't want that. But anyway, the thing that's really interesting is there is really, I think, something very unique about the word utopia. And again, to me, it's more pleasant sounding than New Squamah anyway. But More was really intelligent. I mean, he is a great writer. He was a gifted speaker. And again, he was also a gifted teacher. But even with the word utopia, now he's playing with the Greek language. And in Greek, the word you or you, it'd just be what, like one just writing the word you, the alphabetic word or letter you. It means no, and topos means place. And so essentially when he coined the word utopia and he put that together, it does mean no place. But then if you take another Greek phrase and that use the word EU, not just you, but use EU and place, it's a happy place or it's a peaceful place. And so it's like utopia and the word euphoria would be similar. So it's really a homonym. And so if you spell the word utopia, it means no place. I mean by that just U-T-O-P-I-A, it means no place. But if you spell the same word, it's a different word, but it sounds the same. If you spell it utopia, it means a happy place. And so More actually made up the term, And I think he was trying to really work at telling us something. And if you look at this whole genre of utopian literature, Moore wasn't the first one that really came up with an idea for a utopia. But he was able to coin it and actually fashion it or package it in such a way that it's really caught the grip of humanity. And, you know, people, human beings, I think almost from the beginning, of time, when humans, came to this earth or were put on this earth, people have really tried to find an understanding of what a perfect society might look like. And I do think that this is really part of the way that you begin to explain why do we have so little utopian literature and yet why do we have a lot of dystopian literature. And I think there's just a lot of people really are quite cynical about the concept of utopia. Can you have one? Well, I personally believe you can. Now, I'm going to read to you from this transcript I have of Dr. Bador. Now, she may not be a doctor. Maybe I should just say Instructor Bador. And here's what she says in her transcript. She says, and although the term utopia doesn't get us there, actually it tells us it's impossible to get there. It nonetheless provides a rich philosophical and literary space for thinking about, if not a perfect place, at least a better place. And so this is her interpretation of why she believes that Moore coined the word utopia, because he thought it was impossible to get there. And that's why utopia means no place, but utopia means, well, a happy place. So, of course, you know, we can't interview Thomas Moore here on the radio, and so I don't know exactly why he chose that. But I do think that she does speak for most people in this world that utopia is not a possibility. Now, again, I don't think I agree with that, you know, that there can never be a utopia. But I do believe that it really is kind of impossible right now. And I'll just go through some more of this. Here's some more of a quote from her. She says, so how is utopia defined once we leave Moore's fictional island? Is it fundamentally an elegant philosophical paradox? Is it a blueprint or a recipe for creating a perfect or at least a better society? Or is it a place, like a planned community in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, for example? And what about dystopia, an imperfect or even nightmarish place? Did Moore invent that too? What is the appeal of these two genres? And so she separates the genres. She separates them into utopian literature and dystopian literature. But they really are very both related. Now here's, she goes on to say, why are there so few texts that we can categorically call utopia, and so very, very many of their not quite opposite dystopia, especially since the 1930s? And what does it mean that dystopia is now the prevalent, and she calls it impulse, in young American literature? Now that is, again, you know, something to really consider. Now, I really think that there are many people today that are very cynical about the idea of utopia. I don't think people believe it's even possible. And yet, I think I can show you by the end of the series that it is possible. Now, again, Moore, let me just repeat this. He was a very gifted speaker and writer, and he was a great teacher. And I think by inventing that word utopia, he's really working hard to get us to think deeply on the subject. But I do think he does see some kind of paradox. And I also believe that there's some real fear here in human beings that they're not admitting. And I think we can actually get to that as we go through this introduction. I think one of the things that when I've been taking this class by this, she's a very interesting teacher. She does open the class by telling a story by Ursula K. Le Guin. And I'm sure many people out there know her. She's a very famous science fiction writer. And but she also wrote a really very small short stories. I think it's only about 4 pages long. And you might call this short story postmodern utopian literature because she really handles it in a really different way. And I think she's really seeing the question of is there a utopia from a unique perspective, and actually I think explains why there's not a whole lot of utopian literature. But her story is, again, Ursula K. Le Guin. Her short story is called The Ones Who Walk Away from Omlas. Now, it's really kind of interesting if you... It's like, I think she, like many other famous writers do, she's trying to make up, a name for this utopia, just like Moore did with his utopia, only she calls it Omlas. And when people asked her, where did you come up with the name Omlas? And I think you're gonna be quite amused with this. I don't know how many of you have been in the state of Oregon, but it said she was driving away from Salem, Oregon, and she looked in her rearview mirror and she saw the title, of the state backwards, or the state of the city backwards, excuse me. So if you look at Omlas, she just added a no, but if you spell it backwards, it's S-A-L-E-M, or Salem. And so she just added the O to it. But essentially what it is a story. It's a very short story, like I said, only about 4 pages long. And the story opens on a festival day in this city of Omlas. And the festival is joyous. There is a first-person narrator, and this narrator tells us that the reason why people in Omlas can be happy is because the people believe in it. And so that's kind of like the first indication of what she's saying is that, look, there are some people that really believe you can be happy. And so Omlas, most of the people there believe that they can be happy. Now, there is trouble and in Omlas. And the trouble is, it says, and I'm going to quote from the story, and this is what the narrator is telling the reader, that the trouble in Omlas is that we have a bad habit encouraged by pedants and the sophisticates of considering happiness as something rather stupid. And so again, I think that's Le Guin's way of saying that many people in this world, they do tend to be very cynical about utopia, that the whole idea is kind of stupid. She also goes on to say, this is the narrator says, only pain is intellectual and only evil is interesting. And so I think Le Guin is, like I said, trying to capture, what people think about utopia. And people would see, they would see evil as being something more interesting, but to just believe you can be happy is something rather stupid. Now, the thing is we're not going to read this story on JBL. You can try and find it yourself. Again, it's only 4 pages. But the point is, I think what Le Guin, and this is what Badeau says, is that what Le Guin is trying to say is that actually we do have a good reason to devalue happiness because, well, if you look at our world today, we have war, we have sickness, we lose our loved ones to death. And, there's a lot of violence in this world. Here we have, the threat of nuclear war hanging over our heads. And so, why even be happy? Why even try to be happy? And it's interesting. We'll just continue on with the story, but essentially, even the story is trying to get you to think about, well, is the idea of utopia even possible? And so essentially, in the middle of the story, what Le Guin asks you to do is, well, make up your own idea of what would be in your utopia. And is there a blueprint for utopia? And can we find a blueprint for utopia? And, you know, she says, look, you know, if you want to drink all day, is that your utopia? Maybe you want to eat and become extremely fat. Well, maybe that could be your utopia. But she also brings out in the story, and I think it's very interesting, that she tells in the story that in their one of their most beautiful government buildings, in the basement lives this child. And this is it's a small child, it's neglected, it's undernourished, the child is naked, it is covered with sores from sitting in its own excrement. Now the child could be a boy or a girl. The child looks to be about 6 years old, but is actually closer to 10. The child can remember its mother's voice. The child can remember, you know, that it didn't live in such wretchedness, and that there's two mops in the room, just cleaning mops. They're leaned against the wall, and the child is absolutely afraid of it. Now, what's interesting is the child, the fact that the child is kind of locked up in this, I guess it'd be mop closet or broom closet. Everybody in the city of Almlas knows this child is there. And one of the things is, it's very interesting, is the narrator does tell us that the child has to be there if Almlas is going to stay happy. And essentially what they do is every child in Almlas is told about this child at that same age. So when a child is 8 to 12 years old, they're told, well, there's this child suffering intensely in this government building, but that child has to be there so that you can be happy. And I think, you know, what Le Guin is trying to get across is that, you know, people have to understand that if there's going to be a utopia, someone else is going to have to sacrifice. And again, is that true? We have to ask ourselves, is that true? Does someone have to sacrifice to bring us a utopia? Now, there could be a second way to look at that, is that do we have to go through suffering in order to really understand what true happiness is? I mean, if you think about that, you know, how do we know what happiness is? I mean, do we just know it's happiness because, well, we've been sad at times? And so happiness is the opposite of, you know, objection. And, you know, objection is just a kind of depressed feeling. We feel bleak. We might be heavy-hearted of mind. You know, we get disappointments in life. And so again, I think Le Guin herself as being cynical is, well, look at our life. Look at our life as human beings. We have to suffer war. We have to suffer through these sicknesses. People die, you know. You know, is you know, blissful happiness even possible? And so what's interesting, though, at the very ending of the story is there are some people that decide to leave Almlas, even though it's utopia. They cut themselves out. They go away, and they never return. And no one knows what happens to them. And so if you look at what our instructor, Miss Badeau, tells us, is that leaves some questions up to us, is why did these people leave Almlas? Did they not like happiness? Or were they hunting for a better utopia? Or did they go out and commit suicide? And so you know, I think, again, Le Guin is just trying to get us to think. And I think there probably are some people in this world would not want to live in a perfect society because, well, they may not be able to get away with, well, let's say robbery or thievery or whatever, you know, that means. And so it is really quite interesting. So let me just read you another quote here from this professor from the University of Connecticut. He says, though it can be tempting to latch onto the bleak final option, and that she was talking about suicide, she said, I'd like to suggest that utopia and dystopia are both fundamentally about hope. And she goes on to say, some of the best works of utopian and dystopian fiction from the past two centuries lead her to believe that this is all about hope. Now, I'm not so sure I agree with her, but then again, once we get into these books, and we are going to get into several, very serious ones, then I think we'll be able to ask that question again. Okay, let's take a break, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Just the Best Literature with Dennis Leap on 101.3 KPCG.
Okay, we're back. Let's get into talking briefly about the formula for writing utopian literature, and I think this will begin to help us to understand what we're reading, especially when we get into Thomas More's book. You have to remember, he was writing in the 16th century, and so they had a different style of writing. But it is kind of interesting that when we get into reading a book, it's really good to understand how the books are put together, and we'll also go through when we get into the dystopian literature, we'll get into how the dystopian literature is put together. There is kind of like a formula, or there is a pattern that you follow, or good writers follow. So again, if you look at it, the whole genre of utopia is to talk about a place that is a perfect society. That's when you have utopian literature, what any author that writes about utopian literature, they are going to want to talk about a perfect society. Now, generally they're not written like novels, because there is no place right now on the earth where you can actually go and say, well, here, I'm visiting a utopia. And so generally it's they talk about them almost like a in a second person. They're talking to you. Well, you need to think about this, or you need to think about that. So it's kind of a different kind of writing. The thing that it's important is, if you look at, let's say, the best utopian writers, even like Moore, they really literally believe that there is no place. There's no place on Earth right now that there is a utopia. And of course, I think we could agree with that. Now, we do have the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And of course, we know about that story. We covered some of the Bible in our previous series. But that is kind of like the bedrock story of the idea of utopia. Here there was this perfectly created male, Adam, who, was living in this incredibly productive and beautiful garden. And the great creator God made him an absolutely beautiful wife. And, they were to take care of the garden. They had, all the food they needed. They had the most beautiful environment. And, they were to take care of it. But to remain in that garden, they had to obey God. They had to look to God as their sustainer. They had to look to God as their educator. They had to look to God to, to provide for them. And God told them, look, you can eat of every tree of the garden, which included the tree of life, but there's one tree I don't want you to eat from, and that was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And essentially what God was telling them is, you cannot decide for yourself what's right or wrong. You cannot decide for yourself what's best. You still need my guidance and direction. Well, they ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and then God essentially kick them out of the Garden of Eden. And so if you look at that, even people today don't even believe that was a real situation. Now, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil are symbolic trees. We know that. And so but the point is that still is the bedrock foundation of how to understand a utopia and how to build a utopia. But people don't see it that way. And they're still trying to figure out this formula for a utopia. And so essentially, when you get into utopian literature, even if they begin to talk about a utopia, it's on some isolated island on this earth, or it's on some walled in city that you can't attain to unless you have the rights to be there. But even now, there is some science fiction genre where people can go off into outer space and they can find a utopian society. Generally, even in those kind of books, something happens where the utopian society falls apart. And you can even see that in like C.S. Lewis' book, his science fiction, Out of the Sun and Planets. Something happens that causes this utopian planet to suffer problems. So generally, when writers are writing about utopian books, they are referring to, an isolated place. It generally has its unique set of laws. It has a unique set of commerce. It has a unique set of the way society works. As we move, away from Thomas More, we get into more of the 19th and 20th century books. Sometimes they call, utopia uchronia, and essentially that's a happy society. Remember the word EU can mean a happy place. Okay, the thing is, the second feature in the utopian genres, are the utopian society is a highly functioning society. Now, generally, you can see that it certainly isn't perfect. Something always trips up to take away the perfection. But also, it could be also utopian literature could talk about, a society that's seeking perfection. And they may not be able to get totally there, but in the end, it might still be a better place than where people are living now. Now, the thing is, most of the literature, it takes the reader in as a visitor, and it lets you see, what utopia could be like. But it's also trying to get you to make the judgment: do I really want to live in a utopia? Is utopia a good thing, or is it really a bad thing? So usually it's the visitors that give the perspective of the society. They're the ones that talk about the society. And we'll even see when we get into Moore's book that he actually, uses the Socratic method of discussion. He opens the book with an introduction, and there's this Socratic method of discussion. And really, just like Le Guin, he really leaves it up to you to make these decisions or to make the judgments. Now, the thing that I think most utopian books bring out is that mankind really isn't capable of setting up a perfect society. And so again, people want a perfect society, but mankind isn't really capable of doing that. And I think personally that is true. Mankind in the state that we're in right now today is not capable. I mean, look at all the technology that we have. Look at the advances we've made in science. Look at the advances we've made in education. And I don't see a utopian society anywhere on this earth. And so the point is, I think when we look at the utopian books, is that there's so few of them because, man, I think, inherently sees, in himself that, we're not capable of putting up a perfect society, so why talk about it? And so I think that's interesting. One of the other things also in utopian books that that I feel is really goes on is that utopian books are there to make a statement. It's the author's point of view on can you have utopia or can you not have utopia? And I think all of us, all human beings, do have this desire to have, you know, a perfect society where everybody's needs are met, where everybody has enough food, where everybody has a nice place to live. You know, I think all of us desire that. And, you know, I do think that that really is going to come about. But we're certainly not going to go about it the way we're trying to do it today. And so again, the people that do write about utopia, if you actually go back into like the, you know, the 17th century, 18th century, when you look at some of the more sophisticated writers at the time, they're always very satirical about it. It's like it's impossible. And so again, we'll use more. And again, it's a smaller book. It's easier to read, and it's not as I don't think it's as technical as some of the other ones. But I think you know, if we begin to look now at dystopian literature, and remember the definition that I gave you earlier in the program, or the first segment of the program, you know, the people writing about utopia are trying to get a response from you. And the people that are writing a dystopian novel, they're talking about, let's say, you know, what could happen if technology advances beyond our control, and or what could happen if society as we know it continues, you know, without forming a utopia. And so that's what you have in a dystopian novel. Now, when we get into George Orwell's, and that'll be the book right after, you know, Thomas More's, 1984 is considered like the classic totalitarian dystopian piece of literature. Now, it is pretty dark, and it's going to be a challenge, but if you really look at what Orwell is saying, I mean, there's all kinds of concepts come out in that book that we know of. Big Brother's watching you. You know, the writing is very sparse. It's very visceral. It brings things just really sharp to you. But I think when we get into that book, you'll see that he really had a concern of where society was going. And in some ways, he's actually very prophetic in the way he sees, you know, he looked at his own country, England. Remember, he wrote this in 1948, and so he just took those last two numbers and changed them around. I mean, 1984 is, you know, come and gone, and actually we're seeing more totalitarian mind control today than we did, you know, even 20 years ago. And so you can see it happening, you know, even in this country, especially even with the idea of political correctness. You know, fewer and fewer people are willing to tell their real views on anything because they're afraid of being, you know, censured or, you know, criticized in public. And so, you know, some of those things are happening. But, you know, the utopian literature, again, just to go back, a lot of that, it pictures a society with less technology. It pictures, you know, a society where things are simpler. You know, it pictures a society where, you know, there's not these big bulging cities, but there's more, you know, of a country feel. But dystopian literature, it's a lot of it is, you know, after the apocalypse. You know, they're like after there's like this, you know, horrible, you know, nuclear war, and how does society develop after that? And you know, there's been all kinds of movies about that recently. I mean, let's say in the last two decades, about they're very dystopian in the sense that there really isn't any utopia, but society breaks down, the environment breaks down. You know, cities have been destroyed, you know, and how do human beings cope with that? And so that's really, you know, is what happens with the dystopian literature. But I think there's one thing about dystopian literature that I think is really important, is that the writers that write the dystopian literature, I think underneath it all, there is this fear that human nature is fundamentally flawed and that things are never going to get better. And in some ways, I could say I agree with that, that if we look at human nature today, it is fundamentally flawed. And, you know, when governments break down, when society itself breaks down, you know, look at the crazy things people do. I mean, we can talk about this, you know, over the next couple of weeks, the next couple of months. You know, we just had the Las Vegas shooting. We just had the Sutherland, Texas shooting. You know, and what about over the next, you know, 6-7 weeks we do this series on dystopian literature? Are we going to see more shootings? Well, the likelihood, yes, we are. And so you can see why people, you know, get kind of pessimistic and they get kind of cynical, you know, about it. But I just want to talk a little briefly in terms of the dystopian part of this. Is again, remember, dystopian literature, you know, it's kind of nightmarish. It's everything is bad. No one's happy. You know, there's these, you know, major tragic events to try and overcome. You know, how do you repair, you know, a society that's been, you know, cities have been destroyed and there's, you know, there's no government or there's no organized government. And you know, it's those kind of subjects that come out. Now, again, when we get into George Orwell, remember, his is really a title. It's really about a totalitarian dystopia. And that really, I think, is probably the compelling part of that book. And many consider it a masterpiece. Now, there was a lot of anxieties in 1948. If you remember, it was right after World War II. You know, England certainly had, you know, put itself in horrible financial situations after World War II. Remember, the city of London had been bombed. And, you know, the people in England were suffering. And, you know, but if you look at the anxieties that, you know, took place in England, now the United States also, you know, put itself, you know, into, you know, financial problems, you know, with World War II, but that was handled just a little bit differently. But, you know, it is, you know, he looked forward and he thought, what happens if a government gets full control? What happens, you know, when a government can step in and intervene or interfere in the private lives of people? And, you know, you do have some of that, you know, going on in the world today. I know I'm in the process of writing an article on, you know, what's happening in Scotland right now. They want to ban spanking for, you know, parents. And it's going to be illegal. And, you know, there have been about 50 countries in the world that have banned spanking. And I know that the first country to do it in Europe was Sweden. And recently, there's a crime wave. This is like a second wave of it. And of course, some people maybe want to blame it on immigration, but essentially, what they're saying is there's a rise of gangs, you know, in Sweden, and they're imitating, you know, the American gangs, you know, the Hell's Angels, and you know the American gangs that are out there warring and fighting each other. But so they know crime is rising. But if we look at Orwell's book, you know, he talks about Big Brother, he talks about the thought police, you know, he talks about doublethink, you know, and having your thoughts controlled, and you know, it is. You know, when you read it, it is really a dark novel. It's really scary what happens. And you know, he wrote this in 1948, and you know, he wrote it with a sense of urgency. He had a lot of anxieties, and if you look at dystopian literature, it kind of focuses on anxiety, and so it doesn't give you, let's say, a positive or or, you know, hope-filled look, like our professor said it should. Now, again, Orwell's prose is sparse, it's stark, it's really visceral, but he still focuses on issues that kind of make dystopian literature popular, you know, today. And you know, his novel is really all about power, and in a totalitarian society, or let's say in a dystopian totalitarian society, it's all about power, and how does that totalitarian structure, get power over the individual, and it's really kind of a portrait of political power that really wants to control the lives of people. Now, even if you look at what Moore had to say, a lot of communist thinkers really liked Moore's utopia because it even they thought it had great things to borrow from it. And so even in the perfect society, I'm not saying that Moore has the right ideas about utopia, but he certainly wanted a perfect society, but the communists took what he wrote and they built on it and built communism, and where supposedly everyone's needs are met, and yet communist people have been trying to escape communism since communism has been in existence. But when we get into 1984, he's really telling us, what can happen if the wrong kind of government gets in control. And, that already has happened. But again, it's not like it's over. It could still be happening even today. And, it's really something that we need to consider. Now, let's go back to Le Guin for a minute. And again, she was saying that happiness is stupid, and we tend to devalue happiness, but when we get into dystopia, it shows us just the opposite. And I think this is where Miss Badeau thinks there's the hope that if enough people read dystopian literature, they're going to work harder to develop a utopia. And I think that's what she's saying, is that the that utopian literature, well, there's not a lot of it, but there's a lot of dystopian literature because the writers of dystopia want to motivate people to really find, how do you find and how do you build? Where do you get that blueprint for utopia? And I do think, that is, really, really, really quite interesting. So what we're going to be doing over the next series is we're going to be focusing on Moore for our first book, and then we're going to, that's like the whole idea that got Utopia started. I'll probably talk about some other works, but we won't necessarily get into them in detail. Then we're going to talk about 1984. And again, there are some other novels out there, but Orwell really did keep his, even though there's this totalitarian control over people's minds, and that again is kind of, very scary. There's some other novels, dystopian novels of the same time period that are, have a big emphasis on sex and things like that. And I don't think we needed to cover those in JBL. But the thing is, after that, then we're going to get into, I think, two of the most impactful young adult literature books that I think parents need to be very aware of, and that is The Hunger Games. And then we're going to do the very first one of The Hunger Games, and then we're going to do the very first one of the Divergent series. And we'll talk about, the dystopian writers are really trying to target the young adults or the young people, and, talk about dystopian literature, or to get them into this dystopian genre, And I think parents need to be aware of it so they can guide their young people to think, well, that we do need hope. And some of these novels don't really bring all that much hope out. I just want to do one final quote here from Professor Badeau. And she says, works of utopia and dystopia, often so different in their emphasis, all suggest a central truth about human nature. We all have an innate drive towards optimism and toward imagining a better world. Even when we are sharing visions of horrific, even post-apocalyptic worlds, we sense that no matter what happens, we will not only survive but thrive. And I think that's the best way to let you know where I want to go with this, is that we will read some dystopian literature, but I do think that there is going to be a way where, you know, we do and we will come to build a perfect society. And so that's all the time I have for today. And remember, next time we will begin our new series with Thomas More's much-studied work, Utopia. If you have not started reading More's Utopia, you can get the Dover Thrift Edition on Amazon for about $3. And that's with Prime membership. If you don't have Prime members, it's probably going to be about $5. And also, you may want to go ahead and get your copy of George Orwell's 1984. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. Remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So until next time, keep reading.
Been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.